sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jeremy Ben-Ami, president of J Street. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mavena on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. What an adventurous beginning this new secular year has had. First, the main story was the continuing rise of violent anti-Semitism, with recent horrible attacks on Jews in synagogues, kosher markets, and at Hanukkah parties. There were rallies in solidarity with Jews and opposing anti-Semitism all around the country. And then, suddenly, for a moment, it definitely looked like we were going to war against Iran. And then it turned out that maybe we weren't going to war with Iran, and it had all been a strange, frightening moment. Then we learned that the Boston Red Sox, like the Houston Astros before them, cheated and stole signs in order to beat my Los Angeles Dodgers in the World Series of 2017 and 2018. Is this any way to begin a year? A fine question, you say. The answer is, of course, since that's the way it actually began. But seriously, I've been wondering, is there something profoundly wrong with the world right now? Mad world. I've been concerned lately about the way that the public affairs of our planet seem to be going, with the increasing enemy and isolation of so many people. This is engendered in part by the fracturing of our collective society into individualized slivers expressed by our focus on small glass screens, reflecting our fears more than our hopes. From alienation, some move quickly to anger and even rage. And for the disturbed among us, that can end in insane violence, directed almost randomly at any reachable target. No one knew me, no one knew me. Hello, teacher, tell me what's my lesson. Look right through me, look right through me. And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. The dreams on which I'm dying are the best I ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world. I'm not aware that any of the recent murderers who've taken to shooting or stabbing groups of strangers have come from warm, loving, supportive community environments. Most, if not all, seem to be isolated individuals who spend a great deal of time reading and watching angry internet content on their devices, absorbing and reflecting the disturbed material so readily available there. That circular reinforcement helps many people slide down some very slippery slopes towards violent language and images, while others slither deeper into the dark realm of actual violent action. Does your phone have a feature called screen time that tells you just how long you've spent staring at it over the past week? You know, a notification that pops up and says, your screen time was up 23% last week. You spent an average of 2.1 hours a day on your iPhone. Or, your screen time was down 11% last week. You spent 3.4 hours a day on your Android. Well, my phone does. I never have any idea how long I've actually been looking at screens. My laptop doesn't track this, nor do my other computers or my TV, but I'm always startled to think that most days during a week, I spend more time in direct contact with this little silver device than I do with any human individual. I certainly spend more time checking my favorite apps or texts or emails than I do, say, praying. And I am a rabbi. I am in the people business too, as we say. As our screen time rises, the level of religious connection we experience is diminishing in civilized societies, with other choices, mostly electronic ones, replacing the time that previous generations might have dedicated to prayer or reflection or studying with other like-minded people in community. I know everyone expects a rabbi to talk about the need for community, the essential necessity of having a place and a group of people to which we belong, who know us, and with whom we regularly interact. Human beings are social animals, smart, complicated apes who need other similar animals, other humans, around to keep us, well, sane. It's how we are designed. Yet today, we often spend more and more time isolated, doing our own private electronic thing, on individualized islands. What we need is the balance that a true religious community provides. People around us who care, who seek to be supportive, who reflect the values our traditions teach us. Building a better society, helping the needy, caring for the sick, attending the dead, celebrating with brides and grooms and children achieving maturity, creating holiness through prayer, through study, through individual acts of generosity and kindness. If we can reintroduce more of that, and, oh my goodness, reduce our screen times in compensation, we will have the opportunity to improve our lives and our complicated, weird world. To play us in this morning on, well, sort of that theme, here's Israeli star Dikla singing her song Yihyeh Lanu Tov. It will be good for us. In the song, she hopes that that will be true, and so do we in this new year with its strange beginnings.
Shemesh bachutz, ani mitoreret, boker lachutz, shuv mitargenet leod yom mitor, yodeh sheohevet, rak techakeh, ani od agiha, od yom mavar, alenu beseder, yoshvim al safsal, זרות דוד המלך, ילדים רצים, העיר כבר זוהרת, רק מחכה, כי לי הוא הבטיח טוב. יהיה לנו טוב, נתחתן בקרוב, ונמשיך לאהוב, הוא הבטיח. נפליג בים, ציפורים נודדות, והנוף מושלם. טוב, יהיה לנו טוב, נתחתן בקרוב, נמשיך לאהוב, הוא הבטיח. נפליג בים, ציפורים נודדות, בנות מושלם. רודם הייתה בצהריים, הוא מוכרח לשאול איך בינתיים הזמן עובר, העיר נראית אחרת.
That was Israeli singer Dikla and her song Yihyeh Lanu Tov, It Will Be Good. Our guest this morning is one of the most important figures on the American Jewish scene today, Jeremy Ben-Ami, president of J Street, the pro-Israel moderate organization that advocates for peaceful solutions to the complex problems of the Middle East. He is back here on Too Jewish. Meet Jeremy Ben-Ami. We'll return in a moment on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Jeremy Ben-Ami is the president of J Street, the political Israel advocacy organization dedicated to promoting American leadership and ending the Arab-Israeli and Israeli-Palestinian conflicts peacefully and diplomatically. He's also executive director of J Street PAC, which endorses and works for candidates for federal government. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So, J Street has, I think, now emerged as a really central voice for Israel at a very complicated time. Tell us a little bit about where you feel J Street is now.
Sure. Well, I think that the politics and dynamics around Israel are getting more complicated in the American Jewish community, in American politics, all around the world. I think that from the right of center, the alliance between Bibi Netanyahu and the more hawkish elements of Israeli politics with Donald Trump, you know, continues to move the sense of what, you know, is Israel right or wrong politics and defending almost any action that is taken.
It's becoming more and more black and white, isn't it?
It's becoming more black and white. And on the left, you have, you know, very harsh criticism of Israel. And within that, of course, all around the world, there are elements of anti-Semitism on the far left as there are on the far right. You know, and you have a real sense of Israel is always wrong coming from some of the critics. And I think what J Street does is staking out a position that tries to find a middle ground that says Israel itself is a really just cause, right? I mean, we are all supportive of the notion that the Jewish people have the right to a state and that state has the right to defend itself in a very bad neighborhood, as we're all seeing right now.
Right.
But at the same time, it makes mistakes, you know, and there are things that it does that you don't like, and that's fine to say, and you're still pro-Israel if you're critical of the government. So that's the ground that J Street's trying to stake out in between the ever-growing polarization on the right and the left.
You know, it's such a weird time. I keep thinking about the poem, "The Center Will Not Hold," from the 1930s. Where moderation seems to be a dirty word now.
Right. I'm a moderate, right? And I own it. And I'm a passionate moderate. And I said that when we started in 2008 in our very first radio interview. I said I wanted to create a home for passionate moderates. And everybody came down on me and said, what the heck is a
passionate moderate?
Right. And I said, you know, this is what we are, right? I mean, this is really
Absolutely.
Important because the energy that drives people at the extremes is so high, right? And the passion with which they come at things and the language they use and the vitriol. And so this minority of folks on either end of a political argument tend to dominate. And the majority of folks are usually pretty nuanced and rational and balanced and find themselves somewhere in the middle and often get frightened into silence. You know, and they think that they're all alone in their thinking because they hear three really loud voices from one side or the other. And, you know, there needs to be a loud and excited and passionate and energetic voice for those of us in the middle who try to say, well, actually, there is a way here. And on my good days, I think that the 70-80% of us who hold these moderate views can come together and win. And on the bad days, it feels like you're all alone and everybody's just shooting at you from either side.
It is a weird time. You know, after all, the national anthem of Israel is Hatikva. It's hope. It's not despair. And so continuing to advocate for hope for those moderates among us, you know, like me, we'll come back in just a couple moments with Jeremy Ben-Ami, the president of J Street. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha has moved to larger quarters in our new synagogue location, 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. I guess we are truly wandering Jews. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us this Friday night at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, for Shabbat evening celebration services in our new location at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our new synagogue's at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. We aren't in the mall, but on the south side in our own building, and we'll be there for a while. Join us at 2270 West Ina Road. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, new ones starting soon, and of course all of our great services, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, or go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish community in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about some films that have come out recently dealing with kind of Holocaust themes or the Holocaust itself. Talked about Jojo Rabbit last week. Two other films, very interesting ones. One wouldn't think is so much a Holocaust film, The Two Popes, and then the Terrence Malick film,
A Hidden Life.
A Hidden Life, right, set in Germany about a conscientious objector during the war.
Actually set in Austria.
Austria, right.
And it's a really important movie that intentionally moves very slowly. So it's a full 3 hours with some of the most visually stunning footage I've ever seen. And that was an important distinction between Germany and Austria, because therein lies the key to the plot of the film. The film is about a young married couple in a remote mountain village who are farmers. They have some dairy cows, they grow some apples, they're barely subsistence farmers, and they're part of a small rural community that has, you know, a village beer hall and a village town hall and a mayor, and all those characters represent their community, which is quite spread out because of where it is. So after the Anschluss, where Germany basically annexed Austria, and many Austrians, particularly Viennese, flooded the Heldenplatz, the so-called Heroes Square in the heart of Vienna, to welcome Hitler. And he gave a very famous speech there from a balcony, which is a stain of shame on Austrian history. In the countryside, people didn't necessarily welcome Hitler, and they didn't necessarily see themselves as being part of Germany. And the lead character in this film, the male half of this couple, is a very devout Catholic. He has a strong relationship with his village priest and ultimately with the bishop of the region. But he sees his Catholic identity and his Austrian identity as being incompatible with swearing an oath of loyalty to Hitler. So when he receives his call-up orders to report for military training, he goes. But when they're standing in parade and they're being first like inspected by the colonel or the general or whoever's in charge, he doesn't join in the Heil Hitler salute. So he gets taken off and interrogated, and this process goes on very slowly and escalates to various levels of German military authority and ends up in Berlin. And there's a certain inevitability about the whole process.
It's not going to end well, you know that.
Right. But Terrence Malick takes great pains to show how this guy's refusal to take a oath of loyalty to Hitler affects his children, his wife, his village, his neighbors, his community, and how it affects him. And it's really a portrait in courage and in resistance. There are some themes of anti-Semitism that are very clearly manifested in the movie, although there's no Jews in this remote village. There is a sense of these no good foreigners are coming to take away what is really ours, and we're threatened by their very existence, even though their existence didn't really apply to this village. So echoes of what we hear today about immigrants and migrants and Muslims and Mexicans and whatever from certain quarters of our American population.
Fascinating. It's a, by all accounts, beautiful movie and takes some patience, I think.
Absolutely.
Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Inbal Shtivi, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, Ashlicha. Welcome. Boker Tov.
Boker Ol.
We shouldn't be surprised that a country full of Jews should have a great film industry. After all, Jews pretty much invented the film industry around the world, in America, in Germany, everywhere else. But the quality of Israeli films has become so excellent, and it's only gotten better. And there's an Israeli film, well, there's an international Jewish film festival here that starts today.
Yes, in Tucson. Yeah. Israel produces many, many films each year, both narrative, drama, comedies, a lot of documentaries. It's a big industry in Israel. It's not a, yeah, it is something, and it's influential in Israel as well. We know many of the films were nominated to the International Oscar Film Award. How do you say it?
Well,
Oscar
foreign,
Awards, yeah.
Foreign language films.
Yeah, for in the category of foreign language.
Foreign language films, right.
Yeah. So actually today at 1 o'clock, one of the films that is going to present at the Jewish Film Festival is Working Woman. On Wednesday, I think it's on Wednesday, it's Family in Trance. And two other films are When She Came and Torch. It's a short one. So we have four films altogether presented this year at the Tucson International Jewish Film Festival. Working Woman and Family in Trance are quite unique.
So tell us about Working Woman, yeah, and then about Family and Friends.
Yeah, sure. Working Woman was directed and released in 2018. It was labeled the Israeli film of the Me Too movement. Director Michal Aviad, she lives in Tel Aviv. She has always dealt with women's issues. This narrative drama film portrays the life of Ora. She's a mother of three, and she's just got into a new job, but her relationship with her boss starts as we go along the film to get a different angle. Talking about Me Too, it's about how to interpret different language, how to interpret different movements, signs. Did it happen? Did it not happen? Whose fault is that?
Right.
Who is there?
Complicated stuff.
It is complicated, but Michal Aviad had dealt with these for a while, and this one was received extremely well, both, of course, in Israel and around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows all over, and I really recommend to go and watch it. So it's Sunday today at 1 o'clock. The second film, Family and Friends. Family in Trance.
Oh, Family in...
Family in Transition.
Family in Trans, and it has double meaning.
Yeah, and Family in Transition. So over there, we are following the events of... It's a documentary. It's a true story with real people. About a guy who lives in Nahariya, which is up north in Israel. It's not Tel Aviv.
Kind of rural.
Rural, up north, small town, that is going through a sex change
operation
and process.
Yeah,
it's a serious, and it's a whole thing. It's not just, you know... and the way his family and his surroundings are coping with this change. He's a father of four. Decides to do this and be who he really is, probably. So it's all about gender and surroundings and environment. Fascinating films.
Yeah.
This Family in Transition film won the Israeli Oscars. It's the Ophir Academy Award as the best film. It's and it's very prestigious. I highly recommend it. I think it's on Wednesday. Check that out online.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Inbal. We'll talk next week.
Sure.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie and Maurice are celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary with a group of friends, but Maurice looks terribly unhappy. His best friend, Moshe, an attorney, goes over to him. "What's the matter, Maurice?" he asks. "Why do you look so sad?" "Well," says Maurice, "you remember on my 5th anniversary I asked you what would happen if I murdered Sadie?" "Yes," answered Moshe, "I said you'd get 20 years in jail." "Well," says Maurice, "I would have been a free man tonight." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and stay free. We welcome our Shin Shinim, Daniel Levy and Shai Friedwald, representing the Israel Center, Young Representatives of Israel. Boker Tov.
Shalom Faket.
Boker Tov.
You guys are going to go into the IDF when you return. You're doing this year of service, this Shnat Sheirut, the Shin Shinim year, and then you go back. But you don't just, everybody doesn't just join up at the same time. There's a very interesting testing process that I don't think most of our listeners know about. Can you explain a little bit about how it all works for you guys?
Yeah, to the military.
Yes, to go into the military,
yeah.
Correct.
So it's like a principal that is responsible for all the 18 years old kids from all around Israel. And by knowing your grades at school, majors, what did you learn, they sending you kind of interviews / tests, okay, to different units in the army.
Okay. Before that, there's...
Ah, yeah, of
before
course.
Before that, there's other bigger tests. So it starts in 11th grade. You get this first post mail in the mail.
You get an envelope in the mail.
Yes, which is very exciting. And
old style,
you get,
like
exactly,
in the mail, not
absolutely.
An email, like an actual piece of paper.
And you get called, it depends where you live, to that area. I went for Haifa, for example, and then you get tested. First of all, you get health condition-wise. So the highest you could get is 97, and it goes 15 below. So it's 97, 82, and it's by health condition. I, for example, have, it's called a profile. If you're at the best health, pretty much it's 97. I have a profile of 82 because I have a really high number in glasses.
F64.
And he'll explain later. And that's one. The other thing is...
So because you have a correction,
yes,
you wear
because
contact
I have
glasses.
Lenses, yes,
or glasses,
exactly.
Right? Okay.
The second one is like health, like smart-wise, I don't know how to say it. So they test you, have to read like text, and you have to answer questions, you have to do math, you have to do like different kind of themes.
It's
just
kind
like,
of like an SAT or
like
a proficiency
like that. Just like
test.
Very, very right. summed up, very okay. Like it's a bit of everything.
Right.
And the last one is like life condition, I'd say, if your parents are divorced, if you have to support your family financially.
It's kind of a behavioral psychological
yes,
profile.
Yes, where you live in Israel, if it's a better place, if it's less good. So it's all of that. So that's the first phase. And for girls, there's also another thing edition. It's pretty new in the last few years. It's called Yom HaMe'ah, the Day of 100. I don't know what it's called that way, but you get tested how you work in group works, how you give information. You get a text and you have to read it for the group.
How do you share?
Yes, how you work with like technical, how you solve problems, just like all kinds of tests that have hidden messages inside of them and you have even no idea. And you get tested all the time. People look at you and write down what you say. And it's very, very, makes you very nervous.
A little stressful,
very,
I would think.
Very, yeah.
Wow.
All right, so after that, I connect to what did I say
yes.
at the beginning. And after that, they send you interviews and tests to different units.
Based on your test.
Based on the results of all
right,
of this
the profile,
testing that you
the health
did
condition, everything.
Right.
So for example, I learned physics and computer science. I have 64 profile. I have something in my leg. So I will go to
a
something.
Sports injury or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, sports
right?
injury.
Okay.
So Intelligence Force sent me an interview for them.
Uh-huh.
And not every kid has the process. Different units have different processes. With interviews, physical conditions, tests, different things. And yeah, that's how it
and
goes.
And then suddenly you get assigned somewhere, right?
Right. You get assigned
audition,
somewhere.
Let's call it. You have to pass it. If you pass it, you go to that special unit. If not, if you don't get the special thing,
right.
And I'm saying it in how do you call it?
I don't know. You get an assignment, a specific assignment?
Yeah, if it's not something specific, you just get assigned to whatever the army has a missing person in.
Right,
so you get assigned for, it could be something crappy.
Logistics,
it could have luck.
It could be
it's working, all about luck.
Filing office paperwork. Yes. It could be,
you could be a secretary.
Cooking, it could be a secretary.
Yeah,
anything,
and you could be something top secret and whatever. So it's all about luck, I'd say.
Right.
But it's, yeah, it's
And of course, since it's a military, there are some things that no one will ever understand.
Exactly.
Well, it's fascinating, and you guys have a lot ahead of you when you get back. Fortunately, you have a little while before you go. Thanks so much. We'll
Thank
talk
you.
Next week. Be And now, a word of Torah. This week's Parsha happens to be my personal favorite, the portion of Shmot, beginning the book of Exodus, because it was my own bar mitzvah portion. As you know, we chant the whole Torah over the course of a year in the synagogue, dividing the reading up into a series of weekly portions that begin with the start of Genesis in the fall, continue through the conclusion of Deuteronomy the following autumn. This portion happened to fall on the day I was born, a Shabbat, and therefore it was the Torah portion I learned from my bar mitzvah 13 years later. Now, you'd think that since we have had the Torah with us for at least 2.5 millennia, 2,500 years, some would say 3,200 years, no part of the Torah belongs to any one Jew. But when you spend a solid year closely studying one section of Torah, as our bar and bat mitzvah kids do, and you do so at 12 years of age, you start to feel like that portion is not only special to you, but also kind of belongs to you. It becomes your Torah portion, as though you were the first and only Jew ever to come so close to it. Although as rabbi and cantor, I've studied many portions and have immersed myself in the texts and commentaries of each of the weekly sedras over the years since my bar mitzvah, not a few years, at some level I still feel that Shmot is my portion. There are several reasons for this. First, I really did spend about 2 years studying this section with my father, Rabbi and cantor Baruch Kohan, and of course he is an excellent teacher. And in the course of that time, I came nearly to memorize the 124 verses in the portion, to know the ins and outs of many of the commentaries on it. And while all of this happened a long time ago, there has been an annual opportunity to review and re-explore my portion. Many years, I chant the whole thing in my synagogue. But the most important reason that Shmot has continued to be such a source of interest and inspiration is the text itself of this first portion of the book of Exodus. It's filled with outstanding stories, both dramatic and exceptionally important. Shmot begins with the Israelites living well in Egypt. Then a new king arises who knew not Joseph, and the people are enslaved. Moses is born, and the fabulous tale of slavery, redemption, and freedom begins to play out. Nearly from birth, Moses is the most interesting and important person in the Torah, perhaps in all of world religion. He is courageous, forthright, hot-tempered, humble, persistent, chutzpahdik, in every way a very human hero. At the start of the climactic section of this week's portion, Moses is herding sheep in the wilderness when he comes upon a famous bush. Asneh boer ba'esh v'asneh nenu kal, a bush burning with a furious flame but unconsumed. God appears to Moses out of that flame, instructing him to stand up for his people, go back to Egypt, the Egypt he fled as a fugitive, and liberate the enslaved Israelites. To put it mildly, Moses is reluctant to go. He argues he's not worthy, says no one will believe him, tells God he stutters, comes up with a variety of reasons he shouldn't go back to Egypt. When God answers each of his objections with a solution, Moses simply refuses to go. God, however, has a certain power to persuade. And of course, this being the Torah, our primary religious text, God is right. By the end of the portion, Moses finds himself back in Egypt, his first efforts to liberate the people rebuffed, he himself already discredited in his quest to free his people from domination. The growth of Moses into the protean liberation figure who redeems the Israelites will take two more weekly portions. But the lesson here in Shmot is that if God chooses a course for you, no matter what your personal feelings, you should probably go along for the ride, for one way or another, your direction in life has been selected. Or perhaps the lesson is greater. Many times our reluctance to accept a sacred task, to do what we are urged to do, is simply a combination of obstinacy and fear. We know that we should take a new course in life, embrace hope and promise over the familiar and ordinary failures. but our own inertia holds us back. Perhaps the burning bush can illumine a new sacred path for us, each of us, in this new secular year of 2020, as it did once for Moses so long ago. One final personal note. 5 years ago, I stood at the foot of Mount Sinai and saw what the monks of St. Catherine's Monastery say is the very bush that Moses saw burning but not consumed 3,250 years ago or so. While the identification of that shrub seems exceedingly dubious to me, and even the location of Mount Sinai itself is in some doubt, the continued power of the tale teaches us that the meaning of a narrative is often more powerful than the simple facts. Similarly, our own narratives, our life stories, like our own Torah portions, can have deep meaning, whether or not we turn out to be Moses. Every human story has richness, beauty, and power. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our excellent guest Jeremy Ben-Ami will explain how J Street advocates for Israel and what it means to seek a peaceful solution when peace seems to wander farther and farther away. Find out when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Author Elizabeth Wurtzel, best known for her memoir, Prozac Nation, died last week at age 52 after a five-year fight with breast cancer. Wurtzel's blockbuster memoir, Prozac Nation, came out in 1994 when she was 27 years old. It detailed her struggles with antidepressants. That book started a confessional memoir trend, kind of a craze in young authors. The paperback was a New York Times bestseller, and the film adaptation of Prozac Nation starred Christina Ricci. Her subsequent books were less successful, but no less confessional. Wurtzel was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer in 2015. That same year, she underwent a double mastectomy. Wurtzel later became an advocate for testing for the BRCA gene mutation and pushed for insurance companies to cover that testing for all Ashkenazi Jewish women, regardless of whether or not they present cancer symptoms. I caught it fast and acted fast, but I must have looked away. By the time of my double mastectomy, the cancer had spread to lymph nodes, she wrote. Wurtzel was born and raised in New York City in an Orthodox Jewish family. She attended the Ramaz School, a modern Orthodox day school in New York, before going to Harvard as an undergrad and later Yale Law. She practiced law in New York during a break in her literary career. In December 2018, she wrote about how the man she thought was her father, Donald Wurtzel, was not. Her biological father, it turned out, was Bob Edelman, a photographer with whom her mother had had an affair. Wurtzel was an unapologetically honest voice, difficult, courageous. Michael Bloomberg's presidential campaign has purchased a 60-second ad spot that will air next month during the Super Bowl for a cost of about, $10 million. Bloomberg, the former New York City mayor and billionaire media mogul, is financing his own run for president out of his own pocket. The re-election campaign of President Donald Trump will also air a 60-second ad during the Super Bowl. Bloomberg already has spent $170 million on television and digital advertising. Not that much money for him, apparently, and it's working. His polling numbers have risen steadily. He currently holds about a 5.6% rating in Democratic polls. Since his campaign is self-funded, however, Bloomberg does not have the donor requirements set by the Democratic National Committee to appear in the next presidential debate. A record 2.32 million people from around the world visited the sites of the former Nazi camps, Auschwitz-Birkenau, in 2019. The total is about 170,000 more than in 2018, which also broke previous records, the Auschwitz Memorial reported last week. 81% of the visitors availed themselves of one of the many guides, 350 of them, who conduct educational tours in 21 languages. According to the memorial's online reservation system, close to 400,000 visitors were from Poland, 200,000 from Great Britain, 120,000 from the U.S., 104,000 from Italy, 73,000 from Germany, 70,000 from Spain, 67,000 from France, about 60,000 from Israel, more than 40,000 from Ireland and Sweden. In addition, close to 1 million people follow the Auschwitz Museum's Twitter feed, and more than 300,000 use its Facebook page, while 80,000 follow it on Instagram. Finally, a new judge was just appointed in Washington State by Governor Jay Inslee to their Supreme Court. She has two distinctions. First, Raquel Montoya Lewis is only the second Native American judge appointed to any state Supreme Court ever. Second, she is Jewish, making her the very first Native American Jewish judge ever in world history, I am betting. Justice Montoya Lewis has an excellent track record and already has had a distinguished and diverse career, but this is quite a historical appointment on many grounds. As she said after she was appointed, "My ancestors on both sides of my family survived genocide, survived attempts to eradicate their culture, and yet we survived. I am here because of their resilience, their courage, their intelligence, and their deep commitment to what is just." She should be great. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guests this morning. Jeremy Ben-Ami is the president of J Street, the, well, it's called liberal. I still think it's a moderate Israel advocacy organization in the United States promoting American leadership and ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the trying to create and search for peace and a two-state solution in the Middle East. Everybody seemed to think the two-state solution, nearly everybody, was going to solve things, and now suddenly that's become very much in question. Tell us your perspective and J Street's perspective on it.
Well, the fundamental conflict between Jews and Arabs, Jews and Palestinians, over the piece of land that exists between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea has now been going on for over 100 years, and ultimately, everybody who's looked at this conflict over that century has said that the only way to resolve it and do it peacefully in a way that both sides can declare some form of victory is to partition the land, right? And to say there's a piece of the land that should be the national homeland of the Jewish people, a state of the Jewish people, and a piece of the land should be the national homeland of the Palestinian people. And the British looked at it during their mandate in the 30s, and that's the idea they came up with. The UN looked at it in the 40s, and that's how the State of Israel was created. Everybody who's looked at it over these decades and decades comes back to that. So that's the ultimate long-run vision of how you resolve a conflict between two people over one piece of land, as you figure out how to split it. The question is, what is going to be the path to get there? And at the moment, there's no path, right? At the moment, you have leadership in all quarters that is either not committed to the idea or is incompetent and incapable of getting there. And the Israeli side, the government for the last decade has been dominated by a settlement movement that wants 100% of the land from the river to the sea and wants one state for the Jewish people and isn't clear what you're going to do with the Palestinians. Do you give them citizenship or not? And then on the Palestinian side, you have a regime in Ramallah that is administering some parts of the West Bank that says it's for a two-state solution. I know those folks there. They are committed to it, but they're not very popular among their own people. They are corrupt. There is a competence issue. And could they actually deliver if they sign
a piece of paper? And there's an age issue, too, to be honest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you definitely, and then you have America, which for many decades had played the key role of outside mediator. I often liken this to a bad divorce, that you don't ask the husband and the wife to just go into a room by themselves in the middle of a bitter divorce and just figure it out. You have mediation, right? And that's why you do it. You put the husband in one room, the wife in the other room, and somebody goes back and forth and figures out how to divide up the assets and, take care of the kids, and they come up with an agreement. And that's what you need here. You need, not putting the Israelis and the Palestinians after all these decades into a room together, just reiterate their grievances and the history of who did something to whom first. You need a solutions-oriented mediation, and you probably have to put them in separate rooms and go back and forth between them, the way Jimmy Carter did at Camp David with Sadat and Begin, right, to come up with the Camp David Agreement in 77, 78. And so that's what's needed, and we don't have that either, right? We have this crazy government here in D.C. that has absolutely no strategy and is very much aligned with the right-wing settlement movement in Israel. So it's really a bad time for those of us that think the way out of this is to partition the land, separate into two states. And what our agenda as J Street is both to continue to educate folks here in the American Jewish community about why it is that it's so important to have that separation and to have that partition, and to push for American policies that make it more possible, not less possible, to get to that outcome.
You know, when there's these periods of kind of feeling like you're in the wilderness, like now, the question is, oh, are you being effective? So can you describe some of the means through which J Street is working to try to be effective, even in this challenging atmosphere and climate?
Sure. Well, I mean, the first thing that, you know, we've done is we've created, this goes back to the founding of the organization 10 years ago, a political action committee that endorses candidates for office, because we wanted to make sure that people who were getting into American politics understood that the majority of Jewish Americans do think like this about Israel, do think in a nuanced, moderate manner, that are pro-Israel, pro-two states, don't like unlimited settlements, do care about how other people are treated, because we were not treated well ourselves, and therefore we have a set of values, and what goes on at times on the West Bank does not accord with Jewish values. We wanted elected officials and candidates to know that we exist, and so we created a political action committee called J Street PAC that endorses candidates and raises money for them. And over the course of our decade of existence now, we've gotten to the point that we endorse and contribute to the majority of the Democrats who are in the House and the Senate. And so we now have a very strong voice, and we have good relationships with a very large portion of Congress in both the House and the Senate. And that has allowed us to, for instance, in December, see the passage in the United States House of a resolution making it clear that the United States opposes annexation of the West Bank. This was the first time that Congress has ever spoken out on this issue in the entirety of 52 years of, you know, post-Six-Day War occupation of the West Bank. And Congress, you know, passed this resolution. And I think that's a very important statement. It tells the Israeli government that even if Donald Trump and the people around him are giving you signals that annexation would be okay with them, it's actually not okay with the majority of Americans. It's not okay with the majority of Jewish Americans. It's not okay with the Congress, and you shouldn't go down that road. So that's the kind of thing that we're doing, fighting for funding for programs that promote coexistence. The Trump administration has cut off all funding for everything that we do in terms of coexistence programming, development programming, to try to promote better relations between Israelis and Palestinians. All been cut off in a punitive effort to sort of pressure Palestinians. And what it's really doing is it's hurting the cause of peace. And so we're in there lobbying for expanded, not simply restoring those programs, but expanding those kinds of programs and ensuring that the people on the two sides of the conflict don't lose complete touch and knowledge with each other, which is what sadly is happening over the course of these years now, as they get separated more and more by walls and fences and separate roads. And there's just no people-to-people engagement. So these are the kinds of things that we will be fighting for. We're also taking on other issues, right? We are very involved in the Iran issue. We are part of the coalition that is trying to ensure that we don't go to war with Iran. We supported the Iran nuclear agreement in 2015, and Iran was scaling back its nuclear program, was submitting to international inspections, was engaging in diplomacy. That was a victory for diplomacy and for keeping Iran in check. What the Trump administration has done now by pulling out of the Iran nuclear agreement, we see the spiral of violence, and now Iran is once again actively pursuing a nuclear program and is in, you know, firing rockets at our troops and is engaged in further destabilizing effort, which it had stopped doing while the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear agreement, was in effect. So we are also involved in lobbying and pushing for things related to Iran. We're a voice for the Jewish community on immigration and refugee issues. We oppose things like the Muslim travel ban, and we you know, believe, because we're a community that believes so strongly in immigration and we're refugees, it's so important that the United States maintain that commitment. And so these are the kinds of things that J Street is doing in Washington to ensure that the majority of Jewish Americans who share our views and our values have a voice in the political and policy-making process.
On campus, it has long felt like pro-Israel advocacy is losing. You know, I have a personal relationship to this. I have two kids in college now, one just a year out, and J Street has become more involved. Talk a little bit about that voice and how important that is on college campuses in the United States.
Well, there's a real generational difference in the conversation about Israel, both in the Jewish community and out, which you're aware of, and I think anybody who's listening to the show is aware of, that, you know, for older generations who experienced perhaps even, you know, the end of World War II and the creation of the State of Israel, the Six-Day War, there is just a much more visceral defensiveness around Israel, and any criticism of it and attack on it is, you know, taken quite negatively. And you know, there is a tendency to be a little bit sharper in one's Israel right or wrong, circling of the wagons with the older generation. With the younger generation and your kids, my kids, you know, people born in this millennium, right, they haven't known Israel as the underdog. They've known Israel as the strong military power, superpower that it is, and also, frankly, as an occupying power, right, as a power that is governing with its military millions of people without equal rights. And that rubs against the sense of justice and the values on which we're raising these same kids, right? We are teaching them very well about how to live out their Jewish values and their identity by trying to make the world a better place and fighting for the underdog and supporting the homeless and fighting for groups without rights. And there's a lot of really good justice work that is done in the Jewish community and gives pride to younger Jewish Americans. But then they look at what's happening in Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians, and they say, wait a minute, the exact same values we're fighting for here are not in accord with what's going on over there. So there's a very different generational mindset. And on college campuses, you you know, you see this playing out in real time, where you've got very active pro-Palestinian groups. It's sort of one of the causes of the day for progressives and liberals, and not only on college campuses, but more broadly. And young Jews want to be part of progressive and liberal circles. You know, that's sort of their natural political home. And they're not particularly welcome if they support the State of Israel, right? And if they support, you know, they identify as pro-Israel. And so you find that there's a, you know, progressive camp that's not particularly friendly to Jews or to Israel. And then they go to the Hillels or they go to the campus Jewish organizations, and there's, you know, not a word of criticism of Israel is allowed, and you can't question, you can't even use the word occupation, you can't talk about Palestinians, you can't engage in these conversations. So there's no welcoming home for a lot of younger Jewish Americans on college campuses on these issues. And J Street is, again, trying to provide that middle space where you have your liberal and progressive politics, you are, you know, engaged in so many other causes, and you support Israel, and you're, you know, opposed to occupation, you want peace, you want two states, but you're also pro-Israel, right? And you support the state, and you support your community, and you're proud of that. And that's the space we're trying to create on college campuses.
Jeremy, where can people go to find out more about J Street to get involved?
Great. Well, the most important resource is really our website, jstreet.org. Sign up on social media, on our Facebook page, Twitter feed, keep up with our work electronically. There are also, you know, staff people who are working for people in different states. We have regional teams and regional offices, and you can find out more information about that at the website, which is J Street, the letter J and the word street, .org, and there'll be plenty of information there on how to get involved.
Jeremy, thanks very much for a great visit, and may your work continue to develop. Maybe the center will hold thanks to your work. Thanks so much.
I really appreciate it. All the best to you. Take care.
You too.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest will be Heather McAdam, author of the bestseller Rina's Promise. She has a new book out for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. It's called 999, The Extraordinary Young Women of the First Official Transport to Auschwitz. Our playout this morning comes from Mordechai Shapiro. It's his setting for the Psalms verse, Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, serve God with joy, which just happens to be the motto of my synagogue, Congregation Beit Simcha, and a good one it is. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov and a week, we pray, of peace.
simcho elo elo mitoch simcho o o eina shina shoiro elo mitoch simcho elo elo simcho shel mitzvo o boy you fun of it fun of it na na boy you fun of it na na
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.